From the Sky News Centre at 6, Julian Assange says the dropping of a case by Swedish authorities looking into rape allegations against him is an important victory. The WikiLeaks founder has been in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for almost 5 years, but he's unlikely to leave as police in the UK say they still want him over bail breaches. He's assessing his next step.
My legal staff have contacted the United Kingdom authorities. And we hope to engage in a dialogue about what is the best way forward.
Theresa May is rejecting Labour claims the Conservative manifesto is an attack on the elderly. But she's admitted winter fuel payments will go to all older people in Scotland, not just those judged most in need, as is the plan for England. The Prime Minister says the money saved will go towards better social care. Jeremy Corbyn thinks it'll only bring more problems.
We already have hypothermia deaths in winter. We already have fuel poverty in this country. That will get worse. My fear is that social care will get worse, and we already have more than a million people waiting for the social care they haven't got.
A man's been jailed for more than 9 years after a hit-and-run which killed a four-year-old girl and injured her grandmother. Liverpool Crown Court heard the 23-year-old ran past Violet Grace Ewins as she lay on the ground following the collision in St Helens in March. President Trump will fly to Saudi Arabia later on the first stop of his first big foreign trip. He's tweeted he'll be focusing on strongly protecting American interests. Instagram has been ranked as the worst social media site for mental health. The Royal Society for Public Health says it puts young people at risk of depression and body image anxiety. And a judge in Minnesota has ruled Prince's six siblings are the heirs to his estate. But the decision doesn't mean the singer's fortune will go immediately to his sister and five half-siblings, as appeals can be lodged for the next year. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Every time you say something that's very important, you interrupt and break the argument. Every time there's some fundamental information that's pertaining to this, you interrupt.
Well, I'm trying to understand where you're coming from.
Everything
here
that I feel is so important.
No, because the thing is, you see, I'm trying to understand.
Because I cannot get this information out.
We've got all this stuff about.
Do you think it's been remote viewed?
I honestly think he is a plant to. Whenever anybody comes up with some really serious, important information, he will talk over the top of them.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Is the Western banking system killing the host? That's us, like a parasite, and can we avoid another financial crisis? Not just the two biggest unasked economic questions in this general election campaign, but two of the best books out there, which can help us, our financial journalists and our policymakers, understand just what the implications are of organised crime in the financial system here in the West. Also, an Israeli army IDF sergeant in Hebron blows the whistle on what he now says is the endemic racism at the heart of Israeli policies he was forced to follow. We've also got news of the Bilderberg conference being confirmed over in the United States. Sean Tilley from the 1st to the 4th of June, dug out by some of us British journalists. Our sister show Dialect is here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, would you like to have your say in the new BBC Two series about work no longer being a route out of poverty? Also, we hear about two very different cities from a woman who's just arrived to live in Bristol, from Budapest. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect, or if you can't wait, download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, before all that, joining us on the line is Steve Keane. I think you're at Heathrow Airport, Steve, aren't you?
Yes, I just arrived back from, I've been to half the time, from Vienna. about half an hour ago.
Now, Steve, you've got a new book out. It's all about whether there's going to be another financial crisis. Can we avoid another financial crisis, it's called. I'm going to be a bit cheeky and ask you to tell us, not necessarily in a nutshell, but in a few words, whether you think that there may be another crisis. Because one of the things we keep talking about on this programme week after week is the potential for one, certainly, what with the bubble that's been building up, certainly in the housing market and also in the stock exchange, there's a bubble of kind of unrealistic pricing. So what's your thoughts about and what, you know, why you wrote this book and what conclusions you've come to?
Well, it's actually, people think that you could basically summarise the book with a one-word answer, which is no. But in fact, it's rather more nuanced than that, and it really says that there's a bunch of countries, including the UK, which have already had a financial crisis, of course, back in 2008, which was cleverly blamed by the Tories on Labour Party government spending, but it had nothing to do with that. It was basically the same as the crisis in the United States, which was caused by runaway private debt, fueling a bubble in the household market by people buying on credit and houses and everything else. And when people stopped borrowing money, which happened started happening around 2006, the demand from credit evaporated and the economy plunged from a boom to a bust. And those are countries I call the walking dead of debt. So they're in the same state that Japan has been in for 25 years. And as you'd know, Japan hasn't had a crisis for 25 years, but after its crisis back in 1990, it's been a zombie economy compared to what it was up to 1990. So they're not going to have a crisis, but they're going to suffer the aftermath of one, and potentially indefinitely, given the state of economic policy. Then there's about between 9 and 16 countries that managed to borrow their way through the crisis, including China, but also Australia, Canada, and South Korea and a number of others, and they're going to have a bust because their continued prosperity is based on continuing to borrow more private money than they could manage to finance.
So you wrote a book, actually, I know, about debt deflation. You've written something anyway about it. These sorts of terms, we need to understand them in order to understand the economy. What is debt deflation and why is it so important?
Okay. Well, if you take Bernanke's advice, it's nothing to worry about. And, of course, Ben Bernanke didn't see the financial crisis coming. Therefore, if you said it's not something you should worry about, obviously you should. What debt deflation is you have a boom caused by expanding private debt. And when you borrow money, if you think as an individual, if you, let's say you earn £50,000 a year and you're increasing your credit card debt by £10,000 a year, you're the most popular person on Main Street. But then you get to the stage where you max out your card at £20,000 in debt, and you realise you've got to stop spending, and rather than putting £10,000 more each year on the credit card, you start spending £5,000 less than you earn, so you're spending £45,000, and you suddenly go from being the most popular to somebody who brought the economy down because all people's expansion plans based on your continued spending evaporated. That does scale to the national level. And the example I've given you, you've gone from spending £60,000 a year to £45,000, so there's been a 30% fall in roughly in 25%, 30%, 5% fall in demand from your pocket. And mainstream economists tell you, well, that doesn't actually happen at the macro level because, you know, you're borrowing from somebody else. They can spend less, you can spend more. When you pay them back, they can spend more, you can pay less. It's like a seesaw. That is completely ignorant of the nature of banking. And in fact, we don't borrow from each other. We borrow from banks, and banks create money, quote unquote, out of nothing. And the bank I'm quoting is, in fact, the Bundesbank.
Now, that does sort of tie in with the introduction at the top of the hour, which is looking at the small fines that these banks are paying in exchange for things like being found doing massive amounts of money laundering, as HSBC, for example, was in the United States. I mean, is it fair to say that those banks can pay those fines just literally by pressing a button?
Yes, and this is the horrific thing about it, because when you think about what's involved in being a bank, it's being allowed by a social license. You have to apply to get a banking license, go through all sorts of hoops to do it. But once you get that social license, if you start with an equity of, say, £10 million, and you're willing to have a 30-to-1 gearing ratio between your equity and your loans, you can create £300 million worth of money. And that power is not something which reflects your brilliance, the fact that nobody else could do it. It's simply you've got a banking license and other people haven't, and it's a social social right which should be exercised responsibly. And if there's any need to prove that it hasn't been done responsibly, just look at the history of the last 30 years.
It almost seems, I mean, it may be stretching a point, but I can remember, you know, watching these westerns and things with people managing to get plates of banknotes and counterfeiting. It almost sounds a bit like that. Is it? How close is it to that?
Well, fundamentally, it's the capacity to print your own notes. That's what it amounts to. And what actually goes on, rather than paper notes these days, of course, they make entries in a digital database. But what is going on is fundamentally the same thing, and in fact cheaper than printing notes. If you are allowed to have a banking license, then if somebody, you know, if Tony Gosling walks in and says, I've got this great idea for a new radio station up the road to compete with my current employers, and the bank says, sounds like a great idea, here's £10 million, and by the way, you owe us £10 million. So they've created the money that had let you buy the infrastructure for the station and at the same time obligated you to pay in them income stream of, you know, say 5% interest on that, so £500,000 of your interest to them. So it is something which is incredibly important, incredibly powerful, and should be exercised responsibly. But what banks have instead done, and progressively over the last 40 years, the easiest way for them to create that money is to lend for collateralized lending, largely for house mortgages. And by doing it, they drive up the house prices, and we get caught in a housing bubble. And it's a recipe for a boom and bust economy of artificial wealth rather than what we really need, which is financing useful entrepreneurial ventures like, for example, a new radio station.
Sounds like a good idea. Also, look, QE, can this not simply be used to pay off the $1.7 trillion national debt? Because this debt is spiralling out of control here. We don't want to end up like a zombie economy just like Japan, and it seems like we're heading that way.
That is, this is both the problem and the fact, the non-problem at the same time, because people don't ask themselves, where did the Bank of England find the money to do QE? Because, of course, in the very first year of QE, I think the magnitude was roughly £200 billion. That's a lot of money. That's, you know, getting on towards one-seventh of the size of the British economy at the time. Where did they find it? The same place they found it to do it the subsequent year, they made a book entry. They simply said, to the banks who they bought bonds off, we're going to buy those bonds back off you. Here's £200 million, and see, please give us those bonds, which are valued at £200 million. So our assets rise by £200 million, and our liabilities rise by £200 million. So the central bank can also create money out of nothing, and they could use that power quite easily to cancel the entire public debt.
So why don't they?
Because they're beholden to a whole range of economic theories. Which was fallacious. This is what my first book was called, Debunking Economics for a Good Reason. But also partly because they fear what would happen if politicians realised they actually had that power. And if you look at some of the work, some of the writing by Samuelson and other people who are responsible for foisting this mythical idea that banks are intermediaries who arrange loans between savers and borrowers, a lot of his logic was to say, yes, okay, we know that's not true, but if the politicians knew it wasn't true, they'd be hell to pay because they'd be pork barreling everywhere. Now, that is, in his own sense, that's true, but the remedy there is to give that responsibility to people who actually know that that power is there and are not politicians. But instead, we have this ridiculous thrust on austerity and saving, which actually destroys GDP.
So why are our politicians so ignorant? I mean, do they only get jobs as politicians if they are ignorant about these
No, I blame the economists. And I'm a professor of economics, but I describe myself as an anti-economist every time I come back through customs and ask what I do for a living. And what's gone on is economists have developed a whole range of theories which are neat, plausible and wrong. And they themselves fall for their own little models. And what it's like fundamentally is if you had a model of the universe that said, look, it's obvious that the Earth is the center of the universe because look up in the sky, you can see the sun rotates around us every day, and so does the moon. So therefore, the Earth must be the center of the universe. Now, if that's the case and politicians are being elected with the experts telling them that the Earth is the center of the universe, we wouldn't have got off the planet in any sense whatsoever. So in that sense, economists are peddling a theory which is as realistic about describing the economy as Ptolemaic astronomy was about describing the heavens. And unfortunately, with that, you really can't blame the politicians and the public for being ignorant.
What about the people's QE? This is an idea that's been floated the last few years. And the idea really here being that when the Bank of England creates this money, that it goes into the real economy rather than into things like stocks and shares, into the stock exchange and into asset prices.
Yeah, that's again, there's absolutely nothing technically stopping the bank from doing that. What actually did stop them, I think, if I had to get a practical reason, is that they don't normally deal with the public, whereas they do normally deal with the finance sector. So it was very easy and automatic for them to create money and then buy bonds back off the private banks and off pension funds and so on, which they deal with on a daily basis in what they call open market operations or repurchase agreements and so on. They don't ordinarily do that with the public, but exactly the same mechanism could be used to give the money directly to the public. I did a few fairly sophisticated back-of-the-envelope calculations to say that if you look at the £200 billion that was used for the first year of QE, then if that money completely inflated stock prices by the same amount, and if then households, wealthy houses obviously, who sold the shares that banks would then go and buy to replace their reserves, which don't have any returns, with shares that do give them a return, they would have made £200 billion worth of profit on their shares. And if they spent 10% of that buying goods and services and 90% buying other assets, which is what wealthy people do with their money, that would have driven up house prices dramatically, which is just what England needs, of course, and trickled one-tenth of the money that was actually generated, £20 billion rather than £200 billion, into the private economy. That if it turned over there a couple of times a year in terms of people spending money for consumption, you might have seen £40 billion worth of extra GDP. If, on the other hand, they went straight for QE, they could have had the same impact by directly putting just £20 billion in rather than £200 billion.
Also, if Jeremy Corbyn gets in, I mean, you're painting a picture here of a Bank of England that's rather sort of like an ivory tower, cosseted within the City of London, not really much in touch with the rest of the country. But if he gets in, I mean, is it simply the Bank of England, if they don't like his policies, they'll just jack up interest rates? Because they can do that now, can't they?
Yeah, well, they've got complete not complete independence, but effective independence. But the Bank of England, in this, if they actually wanted to go and do people's QE, it'd need to be a decision jointly with the Treasury. And that is why it's not just a monetary operation, it's also a fiscal policy one. Whereas they go straight and buy money off and buy bonds off the banks. That's what they're doing on a daily basis. And that's why I'd say, again, it's easier for them to do that than otherwise. But I'm going to give the Bank of England a lot of credit here. It's one of the very first banks to come out and say, look, the mainstream economic model of lending is simply wrong. They wrote a wonderful paper called Money Creation in the Modern Economy back in 2014. Since then, the Bundesbank of all banks and the Bank of Norway have joined them saying the same thing. So I think the researchers inside the bank are aware this is a possibility, and they're willing to discuss it. But, of course, it's getting through to the politicians, and politicians are afraid of being criticised by a public that thinks that the government spends more than it gets back in taxes. It's being irresponsible. In fact, that's what a government should do, because that's one of the two ways we can create money.
So, I mean, how much freedom does Mark Carney have? Because I know he's painted as this guy who's from the Bank of Canada, but actually his much more important role, it seems to me, was chairing this committee for regulation at the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland. So if he can do what he wants as a Bank of England governor, surely he should be putting pressure on the government, and he should be himself making sure that funds are available to the government to spend on basic services, building schools, this kind of thing. Why isn't he doing that?
Again, there's a political limitation. He would be seen as treading on Treasury's toes if he did that. And I'm speaking of my knowledge is of researchers in the bank rather than Mike Carney. I've never met Mike Carney, so I don't know what his own position on all this stuff. But, of course, that is a position of enormous power. Now, we can see in Europe, the person with similar power in Europe is wielding that power to be incredibly destructive. That's Mario Draghi. And rather than using the bank's capacity to create money to stimulate the economies, he's holding back on spending and pushing lots of those economies into depressions they don't need to be in. But it seems it's okay for central bank governors to be political to suppress the economy. It's not okay for them to be political to stimulate the economy.
What about, are there any major differences you've seen in the British major parties here in the general election campaign and their economic policy in this general election?
Yeah, well, that's one thing I'm trying to do, because what was quite remarkable is seeing all the stuff about how Corbyn is unelectable, basically based on personality and the cut of his beard. And then he comes out with this radical idea of competing on policies, including such things as abolishing university fees. Now, the only answer that the Conservatives have got to that is, oh, we can't afford it. Well, that can't afford it argument comes back to saying, can you or can you not create the money? And if you did create the money and spend it on university education, would that be a good or bad use of the capacity of the government to create money. I think the answer is yes, you can create the money, and yes, it would be an extremely good idea. That's, after all, what Germany does and a number of other countries do on the mainland. So the whole idea that we can't afford this is nonsense once you realise the state has the capacity to create that money. It's then a question of what's the state of the economy into which that is done. Are you going to cause inflation? Do you want inflation? Which the answer at the moment is currently yes. Do you want to stimulate demand? Do you want to raise wages, etc., etc.? And a lot of those answers are positive rather than negative answers these days.
I mean, am I maybe a bit cynical, Steve, but I look at this low interest rates at the moment in the Bank of England as it's almost like a temptation. It's like saying, come on, borrow this money. And then at some point in the future, those interest rates are going to go up. And that repayment on this enormous, maybe even a $2 trillion national debt is going to cripple the nation.
That doesn't cripple the nation at all, because that $2 million, the interest on that $2 million is paid by the central bank crediting the accounts of bondholders. Again, the thing which people have to get their heads around, and this isn't, you know, it's a generic thing. The government, whether you like it or not, whether you think it should be the case or not, whether you're, you know, opposed to government money or not, the government is the only institution in society that owns its own bank. And that with its liabilities, which its bank notes and its entries it makes into our bank accounts, we accept as payment when we actually make transfers between each other. So the central bank, when it sells bonds to finance the government's activities, and then bondholders say, where's our interest? They simply get their accounts credited by the central bank with an operation that is a matching transfer either from the Bank of England's equity, which is infinite, or an increase in their asset values. It is simply a book operation.
Now, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is waving at me. Martin, you wanted to chip in?
Yeah, I was going to pick up something that Steve mentioned early in the conversation about different countries having a different potential for having crashes. And you suggested that those that have already had crashes are unlikely to have crashes. They're going to stagnate, a bit like Japan stagnated, but that various other countries which still haven't had their crashes are going to have their crashes. Mm-hmm. The question I've got for you is, if the countries like Australia, which haven't had their crashes, have their crashes, surely in an interconnected financial system that we have now, that can't be contained necessarily. Which is what, you know, if the euro collapses, for example, or the eurozone collapses, that's going to have implications for Japan, it's going to have implications for Australia, and vice versa. So I'd just like to pick your brains about how this would actually play out.
That's quite right. I mean, because a large part of the demand that, you know, England's getting for the exports it does actually generate is coming from credit demand in the rest of the world. So, like, Australia's the classic instance of that, of course. A major part of Australia's economic growth, and Canada too, was out of selling minerals to China, where those minerals are being purchased in a private credit-fueled bubble. So, and private, that's very different to public. That it's actually the real danger, by the way, which I haven't had a chance to elaborate on yet. But, yes, if you imagine that China is of the scale of the economy it claims to be, the second largest economy in the planet, then credit in China is currently equivalent to about 25% of China's GDP. Now, China's got a capacity to flip from private spending to public much, much faster than the West has, but it still has to stop at some point. That credit bubble has to burst, and it appears to be bursting in the current year. So that means that effectively demand equivalent to one quarter the size of the Chinese economy will disappear. And then you take a look at the other countries, which are much smaller, of course, but South Korea, in order, South Korea, Canada, Australia, then countries like Norway, Sweden, Belgium, add them all up, and you've got something roughly equivalent to the American economy. And with credit demand being of the order of 15 to 20% of those economies' GDPs, then you're talking about like one-sixth of the American economy disappearing from the globe. That's a fairly significant demand shock for other countries that aren't not going to have their own homegrown crises, but they're going to be affected by a plunge in their export demand.
Well, you just mentioned private debt being a danger. I mean, that's worrying, isn't it? Because we're seeing here in Britain a massive rolling back of the public sector and an expansion of the private sector in comparison to it. Is that a danger? And why is private debt such a danger? Why do you say that?
Because we don't own our own banks. That's the simplest answer. The reason government debt's not a problem is because the government money is accepted in payment of the government's liabilities inside the realm where its currency is valid. Whereas and so what actually happens when the government issues bonds, the government thinks it's going to run, say, like a £10 billion deficit, then it issues bonds worth £10 billion, and as soon as the bonds are issued and prorogued, the Bank of England says, OK, you can go and spend. Now, if you and I ran up a debt of £10,000 and decided to issue bonds to cover our spending, we couldn't go out spending as soon as we printed the bonds. We'd have to actually get money back, sell things. So we don't have the same fluidity on our liabilities the government has. And when you get caught up in an asset bubble, as England did, or the UK did with its housing bubble, Australia the same, Canada, America before it, when you get to the point where people can't borrow that money anymore, then the credit-based demand disappears and it can actually go negative. In America's case, for example, when the crisis hit, credit demand was equivalent to 15% of GDP. When the crisis hit its depth, credit demand was minus 5% of GDP. So you had a 20% turnaround in aggregate demand in the American economy, and that's why it was a crisis.
Now, a lot of this is quite complex. It's certainly, there's a lot of doom and gloom being talked about unless we get things right. Iceland seems to have done quite a good job. Have we got anything to learn from them? I know Bristol actually is roughly the same population as Iceland. I'm not saying we could put a barrier up around the city and run things as if we were a little independent country or city-state or something. But are there lessons to learn from what the Icelandic people have done?
Yeah. The one mistake the Icelanders have still got, and that is they made their mortgage debts inflation adjusted. So if inflation is 20%, mortgage debt rises by 20%, which is an outrageously stupid idea. But everything else they've done is very sensible. So they were, at one stage, they were saying they were going to try to repay all the debt they'd run up, which was equivalent to about 10 times the private banks had run up a debt level equivalent to 10 years of Greenland's GDP. And that was going to be signed off by the president and by a titular figure there. I think it's Prime Minister who runs the show and presidents like a symbolic level. And the Icelandic population, a large part of it, simply surrounded Parliament House with pitchforks. And he said, I'm not going to sign it. So what they did instead was they wrote the debt off and they then jailed a lot of the bankers who had been involved in all the speculation that generated that level of private debt. And by doing it, they didn't have the debt repayment burden. They got rid of the servicing costs. They were told they would never be able to trade with anybody again. 2 weeks later, they were selling herrings to the rest of the world. And they got out of it extremely successfully. So they broke all the rules that are being followed by the bank, followed by conventional central banks around the world, and they're the most successful economy.
Sounds like there's a lot of bluff involved in this. They'll say, if you do this, then this will happen. And then when they actually do it, it's all an illusion. It's just bluffing.
Yeah, absolutely, because they're simply wrong about the nature of money in all sorts of ways. So they don't realise that the government should be running a deficit, because that's one of the two ways you can create money domestically. And they believe that private debt doesn't matter when it's crucial. So if you actually play their bluff, if their model of the world was correct, we wouldn't have had a financial crisis. Now, we did have one. They're still working by the same model and still advising countries what to do based on the model, which did not see the financial crisis coming and, in fact, said it wasn't possible to have one. No wonder they're wrong, but they're bluffing, but they don't know their own cards.
Fascinating. Also, I did mention also at the top of the hour this chap, Michael Hudson, who's done this book called Killing the Host. I'd just like to have a listen to a short clip from here now. And he talks about the current economic model in the Western world being a kind of neo-feudalism.
We won't say debt is prisons, but we don't have to. As long as the creditors say we can collect all the income you make for the rest of your life, we have debt peonage. You can work wherever you want, but whatever you make over your bare subsistence, you have to pay to the banks as interest. And that's what we're going for. It's a kind of neo-feudalism we're seeing. It's the old-fashioned debt peonage. Unlike serfdom, they're not tied to the land. They can move wherever they want, but wherever they move, they're going to have to take out a mortgage that absorbs over 40% of their income. They're going to have to take out bank loans and student loans to get a job. And once they start off life in debt like this, that you cannot wait out with bankruptcy like you used to, once you let the laws be written by the banks and credit card companies, you're back into a neo-feudal economy.
Interesting little statement from Michael Hudson there, and his book is called Killing the Host. In fact, he's done several books. But what is this concept of debt peonage, Steve?
I've got a bit of a dropout there, I'm afraid, on the signal, but I know Michael's views on that front. So yes, he's quite right. It's another form of peonage.
What does he mean by that?
What he means is, in the old days, you used to be a slave. Then you could be lucky enough to be a feudal serf, and then we have liberated capitalism, which means you've got to work for a wage instead to stay alive. But if you have banks extending loans, which you then are required to repay, when they create that money by double entry bookkeeping, not by having to save it up themselves, they can gradually take over the claim on all the assets you have just by the fact that they've got the right to create money in the economy. And this is what has been happening with rising levels of private debt over time. And we get sucked into it because we think if we buy a house and its price rises, if we're levered, and we're levered by a factor of five, then we get five times as much of a gain. So we see it as a positive thing for ourselves. But what's actually driving up the house prices is, in fact, the leverage the banks are giving us. So at the end of it all, when it all comes crashing down, you find yourself having to hand over ownership of your house to the bank. Now, it has created that money out of nothing. It's not something which, there are costs involved, of course, in running a bank, but the actual act of creating the money is virtually costless, and yet that gives them the capacity to take over what are created by us by, you know, blood, sweat and tears when you're involved in building and construction.
Amazing, really, that since they were able to create this money out of nowhere, that they can't afford to run so many high street branches. Places like Glastonbury, Bradford-on-Avon, a lot of the smaller towns around here now have no bank branch at all.
Yeah, but this is partly because we've got a change in how people actually treat banks. You used to go and see the teller, you used to go and see the bank manager. I mean, partly that was a good thing because back in those days, banks were still scarred by having caused the Great Depression, which caused the Second World War, and banks were incredibly conservative after that whole experience and very limited in what they'd lend out, and it was very tough to go and get money from a bank. You had to go and put your suit on to go to see the bank manager. Now the bank manager comes around to you in a Lamborghini and offers you a credit card at your door. So it's that change in the whole philosophy of banking as well, but it's also partly electronic. We don't need to go to a teller anymore. And in that sense, a lot of what we did going to banks was going to get a teller and get some cash out. So there's legitimate reasons for that to some extent, but a huge part of their emphasis is on getting the maximum amount of profit they can get out of the capacity to create money. And if you look at the American data, at some stages, the profit of the financial sector has been literally half the total profits in American economy. And that's just ridiculous. That's the stage where they're not lubricating the wheels of commerce. They're slashing the tires and taking the car.
Well, yes, just last week we had this hack attack on various National Health Service hospitals. The Russian Interior Ministry was closed down, various other plants. How secure is the online banking? Can we get on with that in the confidence that it's always going to be secure, it's always going to work, and it can't be hacked?
To some extent, I mean, there's lots and lots of... bank security is pretty effective these days in general. I'm not going to worry too much about that. But, of course, if some of the cost-cutting, if it actually affects their security, we'd be in dire trouble. The one thing I don't want to see is a cashless economy coming along, because a large part of that is conventional economists thinking they can stimulate demand by putting negative interest rates on bank accounts, and they can only do that if we can't take cash out. That's a large part of the argument behind getting rid of cash. So I'm against that, because I don't want to hand over managing the money system to a bunch of people who don't understand money in the first place.
Because that's happening, isn't it? In places like Finland and India, it's happening. The cashless society is coming.
Yeah, and that's been disastrous in India. Because, again, they to do it in that country when you haven't even got the infrastructure in the first place. You know, there aren't auto banks on every corner in villages in Madras. So this has been a disastrous policy. And I can understand reasons why they try to do it, because they're trying to cut out black markets and stuff like that, but they simply don't have either the understanding of the system or the system itself in place to give it an alternative. So, there's lots of very dangerous experimentation being done by economists with the money system, but at the same time they won't do, which is what is incredibly simple with the monetary system, which is use it to cancel the private debt we currently have.
I mean, if they wanted to get rid of black markets, maybe they should take away HSBC's banking license, because they've been dealing with these Mexican drug cartels. Anyway, let's have another short clip from Michael Hudson, where he explains what he means by the idea that the banking system could actually kill the entire economy.
They are routing around all sense of economic logic to put forward an argument.
That's Max Kaiser, actually. This is a clip from the Max Kaiser show on RT.
What trick are they using?
Well, that's the trick that parasites in nature use. Parasites in nature don't simply take the blood and the energy of the host. They have enzymes, and they take over the host's brain to imagine that the parasite is actually part of the host. And so what we have is the financial parasite gaining control of the universities and the media, people like Paul Krugman and the other people.
Interesting concept, Steve. I wonder if you'd agree with that, that it is possible for the universities to be, for the banking system to take over the media and the universities. Sounds a bit far-fetched.
Well, it's already, effectively, it's happened. It's partly the complicity of the economics profession, which never wanted to worry about the complicated stuff like money in the first place, and so built models of the macroeconomy in which banks, debt, and money have absolutely no role. That's why they didn't see the financial crisis coming, because the cause of that was not even part of their models. But at the same time, if you think about how politicians behave these days, politicians simply couldn't imagine the economy without the finance sector of the scale it currently is. And most of their discussions, when they're talking with businesses, they're talking with financial businesses. You don't have very often industrialists going to meet the Prime Minister and the Treasurer. You've got members of the financial sector going there every damn day. So what actually has happened as a result of that is what Michael calls it the parasite taking over the brain. I talk about what, rather than what Roosevelt used to call the, Eisenhower, called the military-industrial complex, what we have these days is the politico-financial complex. And the politicians really believe they've got to keep the financial sector at its current scale or bigger for the sake of the economy, when in fact it's about three or four times the size it should be, and it's parasiting the economy.
Anyway, we've got this general election coming in a couple of weeks' time, Steve. If you were sitting there after the election as Chancellor, what would you be doing?
I've argued what I call a modern debt jubilee, because once you identify the problem, that the problem actually is excessive private debt, then the question is how do you reduce that private debt? And if you look at the empirical record of the 150 crises over the last 1.5 centuries around the world, none of them have been grown out of. They've all, with a couple of exceptions, whether big export booms or massive inflationary hikes, they've all been got out of by writing the debt off. Now, that's the old-fashioned way to go about it. Since we're in a modern world, we could actually use the government's capacity or the central bank's capacity to create money, to inject money into private bank accounts on the condition that anybody with debt had to pay their debt down so they didn't actually get cash in their hands, whereas people who didn't have debt would get a cash injection. You could even control that and say they'd have to use the cash injection to buy shares in companies, so you could do something to break down the level of inequality of ownership in our societies that way as well. But it'd be a book operation. There'd be doubtless very complicated parts about it, because you'd be end up breaching debt covenants and all sorts of problems with the legal minefield that bank debt is these days, and to securitise bank debt. But it would be possible to just simply eliminate the private debt that way, effectively by swapping government-created money for credit-creating money, reduce the debt burden, and then enable the economies to grow once more.
Fascinating. Steve, just remind us, please, of the title of your new book and give us a little précis of why you would think people need to read this, politicians and everybody else as well.
Well, it's called Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? ? And the reason I need to read it is that our understanding of the economy of money has been perverted by a completely false theory of the behaviour of money in banks in a market economy. And once you see what the actual behaviour is, then you know where the crisis came from in 2008, you know what's likely to happen in future, and you know what could be done if you had the political will and the support of the public to end the crisis. If we don't do it, then we face being in the same situation as Japan, which has been in a funk for a quarter of a century now, without the social cohesion that Japan has. And if you look at what's happening globally with the rise of Trump, with the rise of the extreme right, that's the consequence of not addressing this problem.
And what's the odds, do you think, on a 1929-style really catastrophic crash happening?
No, not that big. No, because one of the reasons it isn't going to happen is that back in 1929, even though we talk about things like the big the New Deal under Roosevelt is ending the Great Depression, the New Deal was actually equivalent to a deficit of 5% of GDP. Now, Obama's deficit when the crisis hit in 2008 was 15% of GDP. The reason the bigger response now than back then is because the government, after the Second World War and after the Great Depression, is a percentage of the GDP is roughly five times as big as it was back then. So government spending, whether the government wants to have it or happen or not, attenuates the severity of a downturn by the private sector. The trouble is all the neoliberal policies are about reducing the size of the government sector, which actually makes that, it's like swapping a large air conditioning unit for a smaller one. You're more likely to get chilled.
Now, what you're saying is 100%. It's definitely not going to happen.
Absolutely.
Martin Summers. I mean, I have to ask Martin. Martin here, who's on our show every week, Steve, says it is, and we've really got to watch out for it. And in fact, he says that almost every week. Martin.
Well, I'm very interested to hear Steve's argument why it isn't going to happen, because, as he says, governments are big enough to absorb the potential shock that a private sector collapse would cause. But as you pointed out, the government is actually being deliberately shrunk to make it very difficult for it to do that. Although, as you say, they're willy-nilly forced to do it by fiscal stabilisers that aren't actually under direct political control. I think... I'm not in academia, and I suppose I feel that in actual fact the danger of a real crash is there because of just things that are not even economic. If there is a minor nuclear war in North Korea, for example, which is not really in the economics textbook, I suggest that would have some impact on your thinking.
Oh, of course, but the other thing which I'm mainly looking at is that because we've ignored fundamentally the damage we're doing to the biosphere, at some point it's about to give us a massive wake-up call. You may have noticed in today's Guardian that the seed bank that's there to preserve the genetic material for our crops was put in permafrost in the belief that that would be one of the ways of preventing it ever being damaged. And the permafrost surrounding it melted, and there's now ice inside that store. Fortunately, it didn't hit the seeds, but that's the level of damage we're doing to the planet. Now, once we realise that scale of damage, two things. First of all, that's a huge shock, a huge crisis. But when that happens, when we actually have an existential threat, that's when we actually liberate government spending. So if you look back to the 1930s, the reason America got out of the Second World, out of the Great Depression, was the Second World War. And even on that front, the UK, which didn't have anywhere near as bad a Great Depression as America, a major part of its stimulus was during the Second World War, where government spending in the first year of the war, for example, caused a budget deficit of 40% of GDP. Now, nobody said we can't afford to build that bomb, because they knew the alternative would they be speaking German 3 years later. And with an existential threat, that's when the government spends up big. And I think in that sense, the existential threat of global warming, when we finally realise it's actually happening and needs to be reversed and it's a huge investment to have any chance to do it, that's what was likely to get us out of this debt trap, but nothing else.
But you see, you've intimated, Steve, that you don't think the politicians are really up to the job to even really defend their position as governments.
No, they're not. So they get pushed by events. They have a chance of doing something sensible if they're being advised by people who knew how the economy operates. Because they're being advised by mainstream economists, they haven't got a clue. So they're doing exactly the wrong thing by thinking they need to balance the books and stuff like that. And it'll only be when they're put into panic mode they do the right thing. And that's frankly what happened with the Obama cabinet. I spoke to Bush's chief economic advisor some years ago, just after the crisis. This is a guy called Ed Lazare. And he said that the state of mind inside the Bush cabinet when they realised they really were in a crisis, one of quote-unquote sheer panic. And then in that state of sheer panic, they weren't allowed to let capitalism collapse on their watch, which is why they threw the kitchen sink of government money into the economy when they'd been advising the government the last 20 years beforehand to cut its spending. So in the state of panic, they'll do the right thing, but only in panic and only after realising they have a crisis that is otherwise insurmountable.
Okay, Steve Keane, author of Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? You've got to read it before the election, folks, if you know which way to vote. You want to know which way to vote. Thanks very much for joining us again on The Politics Show, Steve.
It was good fun. Thanks a lot.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Steve sort of put you in your place there rather, Martin, didn't he?
Well, he's presuming that if there is a crash, the governments will throw the existing textbook out of the window and will do the kind of things that he's suggesting. And, of course, he did mention the Second World War there as a very important part of the getting out of the last crisis. So Third World War, then, to get out of the crisis. Is everybody ready for that?
Well, we'll see. Also this week, I thought it would be interesting to have a listen to this. It was actually something which aired on Telesur English. Such a shame we don't get these on Freeview over here. For example, Telesur English is a South American channel, which is now featuring Abby Martin, who used to be on RT. And a few weeks ago, she interviewed this Israeli army veteran, Eran Efrati, the sort of person I think we should be seeing on the BBC, but we're not. He's a young Israeli IDF sergeant in Hebron, and he explains what life was like for him when he first started doing his patrols around the city.
This is the only city that have a settlement in the middle of the city. So getting into the Hebron, one of the first things that I had to do was protect a Jewish holiday. And my job is to put on curfew 180,000 Palestinians. So settlers from throughout the West Bank and Israel, Jewish settlers, could come into Hebron and celebrate. So there's thousands and thousands of Israelis and Jewish settlers from across the West Bank coming to celebrate. And the only way to keep them protected is to make sure that no Palestinian is leaving his home. So literally one of my first tasks was to roam the streets and make sure Palestinians understand they're going into their home and they cannot leave until a second notice, until the next time we're coming in. And the first time was like a movie. You know, we birthed into the city with our guns in our hands and our uniform and vest with grenades and six packs of ammunition. And we're just screaming curfew. And you see the chaos. You see the people just running from place to place, closing down their shops, running home. Because wherever you are when the curfew starts, this is where you're stuck. And you cannot go anywhere else. So you better be at home when we're starting to count the curfew. Now, the official orders to anyone who breaks curfew is shoot to kill. I never did that. I never met anyone who shoot to kill in this process of a curfew. But that was the orders, and they knew it pretty well. They knew what they need to do. This feeling of power at once came as a big confusion to me. I think I wasn't clear if I'm enjoying the power of controlling all of these people or if I don't understand why kids look at me frightened. And I think in a very rapid pace, I realized that my job is actually to maintain an apartheid system. Very early on, I understood that the rights that the Jewish settlers have are not the rights that the Palestinians have. I understood that I cannot touch a Jewish settler if he is attacking a Palestinian. The best I can do is call a local police department to come handle it, like I would do at home in Jerusalem. So these Jewish settlers that live in Hebron are living under the same rights that I live in Jerusalem, but the Palestinian next to them, next house over, next building over, sometimes next apartment over, lives under my rule, my military rule. And I can do whatever I want with him. I can take his home as a temporary base for a few hours to a few days to a few weeks. I can decide that I'm arresting the people of the house and tying them up to the fence of my base. If we will get an order to demolish their home or just lock their front door and don't let them out into the street their house is on, a street that only Jewish settlers can walk on. And Palestinians cannot, so they have to walk through windows to yards, into the other side, into the Kasbah of Hebron. I think realizing all of that in a very, very early stage in my service helped me understood that someone was lying to me along the way. I didn't feel like I'm protecting anyone. I didn't feel like I'm helping anyone feeling more safe. I felt like I'm terrorizing people. I feel like for the first time in my life, the boundaries between good and bad that I learned as a kid, and obviously I learned that I'm on the good side, was broken. I felt like I am the terrorist. And my job was literally to scare people so they cannot think about acting against the Israeli settlers or the Israeli military. That was actually our defined mission, to instill fear in the hearts of Palestinians in Hebron. And that's exactly what we did.
That was the former sergeant in the Israeli Defense Force. His name's Eran Efrati, talking about Hebron. Interesting, the pronunciation of completely different to the way we pronounce it. Hebron. He pronounced it there, Martin. But look, this is deadly serious stuff, isn't it? I mean, they're just there to induce fear. Also, people having to crawl out the backs of the houses because there's a whole street in which they're just simply not allowed to walk on. And he himself is saying this is apartheid.
Well, that's right. And of course, it's the occupation in the West Bank is not dissimilar to other occupations that are going on around the world. It's why should the Israelis not be treated the same as anybody else if they're breaking international law?
The main take home from this is it's such an interesting, important whistleblower right from the centre of things, and yet no sign of him on the British media anywhere.
Well, no, because there's an awful lot of what they call Hasbara, which is the psychological warfare wing of the Israeli state, which engages in an awful lot of propaganda and disinformation. So we found out from the Al Jazeera sting on the Israeli embassy that the Israeli embassy has spent £1 million inside the British Labour Party to buy compliance with their policies. It was a 24-hour wonder on the media, but then it was forgotten about. Meanwhile, we're going on about how the Russians are controlling everything. I mean, in actual fact, it's fairly clear who's pulling the strings, at least inside the British Labour Party.
Also, elections over in Iran today. Rouhani is standing again. He's seen as someone who really wants détente with the West, but there's a front runner. It seems to be anyway in the exit polls against him. Is this guy Raisi? I'm trying to just find out his first name. Could be President Raisi, who is more of a hardliner. He's 56 years old, and I just wonder what you make of the difference between the our democracy we have here and what they have over there. They have a much more sort of proper proportional system than we do, and also they're electing all their local government all at the same time.
Yeah, well, it's a controlled democracy because, of course, Khamenei, the supreme leader, it's a theologically controlled democracy, so they can decide who can and can't run and what the parameters will be. But of course, it's by far the most democratic country in the Middle East, and in that I do include Israel. Israel claims to be a democracy, but basically, if you include the Palestinians, it's not democratic at all. Iran is semi-democratic, and of course, our glorious ally, Saudi Arabia, where Trump is going to visit next week. When are the elections in Saudi Arabia again, and who's going to win? Can you remind us? There aren't any other.
So what are your thoughts as to which way this is going to go?
I mean, obviously, I don't know. It's very hard to say. It's clearly a competitive election. That's the point to recognise. There are two candidates with very different proposals to put to the people, and if one wins, the policy will be one kind of policy, and if the other wins, the policy will be a different kind of policy. Unlike in many other countries in the world, where the policy is determined by the banks and the military-industrial complex, and whoever wins the election, it's not going to make much difference. And in that, of course, we would include the United States of America, where Trump promised various things. He's now had his legs broken, and we are going off to war with Russia, even though he doesn't want to. He's being made to.
Okay, also laptop gate, I suppose you would call it. Exploding laptops. Apparently the Israelis and the Jordanians told the Americans and Trump about this potential exploding ISIS laptop story. And because the US president then told the Russians that they had to watch out for exploding laptops, there's a massive hoo-ha about it. People are talking about we've got to impeach Trump.
Well, do you know what? I don't necessarily believe the Israelis and the Jordanians when they say they're exploding laptops. We know that the Israelis in particular are involved in false flag terrorism and disinformation. Now, Trump, in any case, as he's pointed out in a tweet, he's got the right to say anything to anybody. The President of the United States gets all the security briefing. He then decides not to do what to do with it. Nobody else. He's the Commander-in-Chief. At least Truman was the Commander-in-Chief when he sat MacArthur in the Korean War. But is that any longer true? The reality is that the Pentagon runs US policy and Trump is a puppet.
Another major international story today. US has attacked pro-Assad forces, rebels that are supporting the Syrian Arab army in southern Syria. So the Americans are backing with their jets bombing anti-ISIS forces.
Yes, well, there's a British connection to this because British special forces are inside that base, inside Syria. We've not discussed this in Parliament. We did vote.
No, hang on, because where special forces are is not a matter for Parliament. They are completely outside the control of MPs.
All right, well, let's put it this way. Nobody's denying that British special forces are in this base inside Syria. And therefore, as these militias and Syrian government forces move to try and control the border, which is what they're trying to do, they move towards this base. And on that basis, the US then bombed and killed quite a few members of the Syrian armed forces. Now, I would put it this way. British armed forces inside Syria are breaking international law. And up to now, the Syrians and the Russians have not retaliated for any of their over 100 people that have been killed by NATO forces. Maybe next time they will. And of course, if they do retaliate, they shouldn't just do it small style. They should go for it and just drive the British and the Americans
out of Syria. Also, Martin, massive protests over in Venezuela too.
There's massive protests in Venezuela ongoing because there's a potential civil war between the wealthy classes who won't accept the Maduro presidency and the popular classes who are not prepared to have him removed. And the danger of civil war is palpable in that country because the methods being used by the opposition in Venezuela are definitely the kind of methods that were used in Syria, i.e. shooting police officers, etc.
Let's just finish.
Is that okay?
Let's just,
I don't know. Should we shoot a few Saudi police officers?
Let's just finish by comparing, in a kind of trite way, really, the British electoral system and the Iranians, because they've got very, very high turnout levels over there. Mm. We had 85% of Brits turned out to vote in 1950, just after the Second World War. We're now down to around about 65%. Is there anything going to be done to actually get people voting again?
We need to change the electoral system, point number one, and of course it has been changed through war in Ireland and through political agitation in Scotland. We need to change the electoral system. We need to have a citizen's income with everybody looked after, but you get your citizen's income only if you participate and vote.
Interesting theory. Okay, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with, well, it may be live, we'll see, and with Mohammed Makawi and Yusuf. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe, Helen Holland, and Lib Dem Councillor for Cotham, Anthony Negus. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, and to Professor of Economics Steve Keane. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This show's story links and comments page. Leave a comment. If you don't like it, or you do, or you want to inform us or whatever, use thisweek.org.uk. You can leave a comment there. You can download our MP3s, listen in the car, iPlayer, or anywhere you like. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Billy Quain, Saturday edition tomorrow morning at 10, and The Real Musical Deal Sunday evening at 7 with Danny Lopsch. I'll leave you with music from 1992. Yes, I think it's fair to say. This is Sabrina Johnson. Do please join us at the same time next week for our Bristol West Hustings show, which looks likely to be taking place with all the main candidates except Thangam's Debonair. So let's hope that she manages to make it between now and then. God bless. Don't let the banksters get you down. That you were for. It gets better.